This is Dear Analyst, episode number 71. And this episode, I am super, super excited to have someone I wanted to have on the show for quite a while. It's Ben Stancil, who is the Chief Analytics Officer at Mode Analytics. He's also one of the co-founders. And yeah, the reason why I really wanted to have Ben on the show was because I use Mode probably every day at my company. And definitely very familiar with the tool. And what better person to talk about analytics than the man himself who created this product. So thank you so much, Ben, for being on the show.
Awesome. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here and always good to hear from happy Mode users.
For sure. Yeah. And do you want to just quickly give everyone some of your background before you started Mode?
Sure. Yeah. And I can start kind of at the very beginning and run through it quickly.
Sure.
So I did like math and economics in college. After school, I worked in DC for a few years for a think tank doing economic policy research. And so I focused on basically writing policy papers that nobody ever read for Congress and for other people, you know, who were making economic policy about the macro issues of the day. And so this was between 2009 and 2012. So it was primarily around the 2008 financial crisis and the after effects. It was very interesting work. And from a data perspective, it was very interesting to go sort of digging through the various things happening in the economy, especially during that point, because the whole world was kind of turned upside down. But as someone who was 24 at the time or whatever, you get sort of frustrated by not having actually any impact because you're writing a bunch of reports, you're doing a bunch of analysis, you're kind of coming to things that you think are interesting conclusions that are then six steps removed from anybody actually doing anything about it. And so academically speaking, it's interesting, but you don't actually see if the things you're recommending are right or not because nobody actually enacts them. So from there, I actually ended up moving out to California through some like friends of friends type of thing, found a job at a tech company called Yammer. Yammer was a enterprise social network, was how they marketed themselves. It was very similar to Facebook for Work before Facebook for Work existed. And I worked on the analytics team there doing product analytics kind of in the early stages of how people really thought about product analytics. So we modeled a lot of our work off of what gaming companies had done for gaming. So how do we, you know, boost engagement, boost growth, things like that, and use data to make some of those decisions. A couple of years into that role, well, so shortly after me joining Yammer, we got acquired by Microsoft. So Yammer was purchased by Microsoft in 2012. Stayed on for a little bit longer. And then me and two other folks who I worked with on Yammer's analytics team left to start Mode. And so we created Mode in 2013. And I've been working on it ever since, kind of with a variety of different roles while you're there. As for anybody who's started or been an early stage company before knows, you bounce around a lot, kind of do what's necessary. And you have a job title and a role. And those are two very different things. And so worked on things from the marketing side to support to product to customer success and solutions, and now and much more still working. I've always in that the course of that thought a lot about our like data team and how we do data internally and those sorts of things. And that's kind of where I am today.
Cool. And I know in one of your blog posts in your Substack, you talked about when you first started Mode, and I believe you said something along the lines of you didn't have much to do because you weren't an engineer and all the fundraising stuff was being handled by the CEO. So you're kind of like left without a job. How did you, I think a lot of folks who aren't like a technical founder or engineer, they kind of can fall into that mindset. And how did you navigate like what to work on? It sounds like you just kind of wore a bunch of hats. Is that sound about right?
Yeah. So, you know, day one of starting Mode, there were three of us. There was Derek, our CEO. There was Josh, who was our CTO and kind of the technical co-founder, and he's the one who built a lot of the internal tools at Yammer that were sort of the inspirations for Mode. And then there was me. And so Derek, as the CEO and as the charismatic and affable one, was out talking to investors, was building relationships with potential customers, doing all the things to sort of start building the necessary demand for Mode and figuring out kind of how we're going to start growing the business. Josh, as an engineer, was building the first versions of the product. You know, the first few people we hired also were all engineers that were focused on building the product. And then there was me. And like you could ask them why was I included in that group of three people? I have no idea. That's a question that they'll have to answer. But you don't have a lot to do. Like my expertise, to the extent that I had expertise as a, you know, what, 26-year-old, whatever it was data things. It was being an analyst, it was thinking about data, but we didn't have any data. We didn't have any customers. We didn't have any users. We didn't have anything to look at. So what I did, and I don't, honestly, I can't really say why I ended on this, why this is what happened, but it was like, well, I'll do this because I think it'll be fun. I just started writing blog posts that were about data, but not about data products. So this was pre 538 being 538, like Nate Silver was Nate Silver, but 538 as a website wasn't 538. The kind of concept of like data journalism wasn't really a thing. So I was basically like, well, I'll just write some stuff that is kind of in that vein. I'll, you know, find topics I'm interested in and write blog posts about that, with kind of the rough idea that if I'm interested in this, then other people who are data people might be interested in it. We're going to one day have to sell to data people when we build this product. And therefore, maybe we'll start to build an audience that way. Like it was kind of a rough plan of content marketing strategy that we certainly didn't think of in that particular way. And so that was what my job was for 6 to 9 months. And it worked reasonably well, honestly. Like it actually, I think people appreciated that we weren't writing kind of the thinly veiled marketing content in semi-helpful listicles. We were just like writing stuff that we thought was interesting. And I think that our own interest came through in what we were publishing. And so people were like, oh yeah, this is kind of interesting. So we ended up building a little bit of an audience through that. And then once Mode started developing customers and other things happened or other needs around the business, that's when my role started to shift to, okay, well, we need to support customers. We need to talk to them. We need to figure out what they want. We need help on these areas. Then I became kind of a go fill the role that we currently need someone to fill.
Gotcha. And when going back to those first, I guess, content marketing days, can you remember any blog posts that you authored that really kind of struck a vein with other analysts and people in the data environment at the time?
There were a couple that I remember being good with the analyst folks, and a couple that were sort of just more broadly interesting, I guess. With the data folks, there was one about Facebook. And so in Facebook's early days, one of the kind of legends of Facebook is they discovered this like magic metric of if you get 7 friends in 10 days, I think that it might be 10 friends in 7 days or something like that. But anyway, some number of friends in a certain number of days, then you basically become a Facebook user for life. And so a lot of the Facebook team kind of oriented around the strategy of, okay, the thing we have to do to grow is get people to have this many friends in this many days. So the post was kind of like, how did Facebook arrive at that? Like, how do you as a company that's not Facebook find your version of that? And what does it actually mean? Those sort of a walkthrough of different ways to think about that, which I think, again, you know, there's sort of this lore around that thing that's well known kind of in Silicon Valley. And so that post, non-analysts, honestly, it was things that were sort of explorations of data that I think people thought was interesting and told a story that they didn't see otherwise. A couple that come to mind was, there was one I did on basically scraping a bunch of data on the hometowns of college football players and seeing where different college football players like grew up and like which parts of the country produced more college football players than others. I don't remember what the conclusion in it was, to be entirely honest, but it was one of those things that it's just a slightly different cut at something that nobody's seen before. And I think people are always just kind of fascinated by, hey, there's some new way to think about this thing or some new visualization of some bit of data that I've kind of mentioned in the subject on that one tapped into better than others.
Cool. And I'm not sure how developed the Mode platform was at the time, but what tools were you using to analyze data, script the data? Was it like Python, Excel? Can you give a list of the tools?
Yeah. So Mode was not really a tool at that point. I probably was trying to use it, but it was one of those things that, you know, it was a half-baked product on someone's laptop somewhere, probably at that point. So I'm sure there was a lot of Excel because, one, that was the world that I had come from. I had come from DC, which primarily was still kind of an Excel type of world. I knew a little bit of R from college, so I did some stuff in R. I did not know much Python, though I was like trying to teach myself a little bit of that. So I probably didn't use much Python, but I taught myself some Python for like the web scraping part of it, but it wasn't the analysis. It was just like the collection. And then on some of it was, and this was one of the things, like one of the reasons I think I did the football players thing was because I wanted to make a map and I wanted to learn how to use D3. And so I ended up making it in D3 and just like hosting it on like a GitHub Pages website, some D3 thing. In that, I think there's, I certainly wasn't doing this intentionally, but I think there is like a bit of a lesson in that, which was I had tried to teach myself some of that stuff before, but when I had done it, I was done it on kind of like toys where it was like, all right, I want to go through the step-by-step, learn this. And it never really stuck. It wasn't until I had an actual thing that I wanted to build where I was like, I'm working towards this map to show this data. I want to create that. That's what kind of got me over the hump to finally learn some of those things was there was a end product that I was chasing as opposed to, I just want to learn this and I want to kind of go through the tutorials to learn it. It was tutorials are a means to an end, not the ends themselves.
Right. Yeah. I think I was hearing some other podcasts where they're saying like when you interview like new engineers or something and they're showing the portfolio and they see the same tutorials that they've gone through because like everyone goes to the same tutorials on like Udemy or whatever. And it's like, you just went through the tutorial step by step and you didn't change it to meet some problem that you wanted to solve. So it's interesting to hear that you had a problem to solve and you use the tools to solve it. So that's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's so hard to do. And in this, I think it's particularly true with like learning analytical tools. It's so hard to do it when you're just doing it for the sake of learning it and not for the sake of what you're trying to produce. Not just because I think you don't have like the motivation as much and like you sort of are just going through the motions. But one of the other things I realized in the course of doing this was if you're doing it, especially if you're like trying to learn analysis, if you're doing it on top of something that you kind of understand or something you're interested in, there are two other ways that it actually makes it better. One is you notice when you did something wrong. So if you're like working on like a toy data set and I'm like working on a data set on something about, I don't know, clouds and like science of clouds and how much rain plays in that. And I get something that's like a wildly off answer. I'm never going to know it. I'm never going to realize that. But if I'm doing something on something I'm familiar with, you know, and I work on this college football thing and it says that 100,000 college football players came from one county, I'm going to be like, you know what? That's probably wrong. Like I probably didn't do that right. And so it gives you this ability to kind of smell some of these things out. It also pushes you to answer questions that you didn't think of. Whereas the tutorials, you should go just as far as the tutorial takes you. When you're actually doing something on your own, you see something that looks interesting and you're like, oh, I wonder why that happened. I need to keep learning more so I can figure this thing out as opposed to, okay, I learned the technique or the skill and I'm ready to move on.
Gotcha. And that kind of leads me to my next question. And this is a very big question. A lot of people ask me like, how do I become a better analyst? How do I become better at doing this type of analysis? And I know you've of course published a whole ton of stuff on different exploratory analyses that you've done in the past. Mm-hmm. What are some high level skills, techniques that you've gained along the way to become better at doing exploratory analyses?
First and foremost, I think it's, you gotta be curious, like, and curious about what you don't understand and trying to figure out why you don't understand it. That say you're given a data set. I think there's a tendency for people to say like, all right, let me explore the data set and let the data set guide where they go. Like what data does it have? Oh, I want to look at it by these different things. Let kind of the data generate the questions. I think it's much better to go the other way, where it's like, okay, think about what this thing represents. Think about what it's trying to, you know, what this data set potentially contains. What questions do you have about it? What given this information do you have is something that you're curious that you want to know. And when you do that, like if you get an interesting result, ask, why did you get it? What else can you explain about it? Like that seemed unexpected. What else, you know, why is that the case? If you get something that's expected, ask, could this be wrong? Like, what is it that would make this not true? What are ways that we can take this further? I think you have to keep, the most interesting questions that you get to are not the ones that you start with. Like the first question you ask is never the best one. And so you have to kind of let yourself be pulled in these different creative directions and work on stuff, see where it takes you and keep going. And so it's not really like a, a tool or a technique so much as it is a mindset around being kind of relentless and thinking there must be a better answer out there. Or that if you get something and you're like, this is what my conclusion is, asking what would make this wrong or why might it be this way and the explanation isn't what I think it is. Come up with some of those ideas are and see if you can prove or disprove them. Because the if you just stop it like, okay, I think X is going to be related to Y in this way and you find something that shows that, you're like, okay, I figured it out and that's my conclusion. But like, ask yourself, like, are we sure about that? Like, what else is there that might explain it? Is there something else that's driving this? Are there other things that are related like this? Like, answering the question isn't the hard part. The hard part is coming up with it. And I think a lot of times to come up with it, you just have to keep, you have to keep digging and kind of never really be satisfied.
Right. And I'll link to your Substack in the show notes here where you do describe some of these analyses you've done. But can you think of a recent analysis, or I guess even going back, where you had like an unexpected results that led to you asking more questions, which then led to the real interesting questions and answers? Can you think of anything that comes to mind?
So, okay. So I can, this is something that this is like, speaking of the Substack, this is something I probably will, like, I haven't actually published it or posted it anywhere yet, but I probably will soon. So you get a bit of a preview here. And this is like a weird, nerdy data question that I'm sure most people don't ask, but it's the kind of thing that I sit around and be like, I really wonder if. So right now, it's the start of the NBA playoffs. A lot of really good teams are playing one another. A lot of times games will be kind of tied, like close going into halftime. In some of those cases, the teams who like will have played well, in some cases, they will play poorly going into halftime. As a fan, watching those games, if you know it's the score is tied at halftime, sometimes it's like, well, great, my team played, we're tied, but the team played really badly. Surely we'll like improve in the second half and we're in good shape. But sometimes you also think like, hey, we played great in the first half. We just got to keep it going. The other team's so lucky they kept up. Like, we just keep playing that way. We'll be better and we'll like win the game. So the question really is, the question I had was, given that the score of a game is tied at halftime, are you better off having played well or having played poorly? Like, would you rather have played badly or played well in the first half, given the score's tied in the second half, given the score's tied at halftime? So I tried to figure out a bunch of stuff about this and like basically scraped a bunch of data from the NBA websites and stuff to figure this out and like got some answers that seemed to suggest one thing and basically suggested like, overwhelmingly, you want to have to play badly at halftime or play badly in the first half. Like, if you play badly in the first half and the score is close, you're definitely going to win. And so I started getting, so I was like, this was like a really strong conclusion. And I was like, why is this sort of digging into this? What's the story here? And so you start to ask yourself, like, why might that be the case? Why is it that you're so much better having played poorly rather than having played well? Part of it is probably real. There's like some regression to the mean. But a big part of it, which I discovered after trying to collect some more data and figure this out, was when that happens, when one team has played badly and they're down at that or they're tied at halftime, it mostly means that team is just way better. Like, it's, you know, a game with some great team and some terrible team, and the great team just like has a bad first half. And so they're playing roughly, you know, they end up with an even score, but it's more a representation of just like the quality of these two teams than it is whether or not the first half is predictive of the second half. And so it was like that unexpected result. I could have stopped and said, hey, look, this is a really strong result. Let's go talk about it and present it and share it as that. But I think you have to kind of keep asking, like, well, why might that be the case? Why this seems unexpected to me. Why am I getting a result that looks like this? Is there more to this story? And so in this case, it turns out there was. Kind of interesting that it didn't sort of fully change it. It actually turns out if the teams are pretty evenly matched, you'd still rather play worse, which is kind of interesting. But it's not nearly as strong as it was before. And, you know, if you're doing this in like a business context, obviously that's like sort of my own just curiosity. But if you're doing this in like a business context, say you're trying to figure out, you know, should we do this marketing campaign or that marketing campaign? And we end up getting these huge discrepancies. It's easy to kind of be like, yeah, okay, great. Let's go do this other one because look at how much better it performs. But often if you get those sort of answers, you get something that seems so clear, there's other reasons that are at play. And it's like, let's understand why it is that maybe that's wrong. What else might there be? And then you start to realize, oh, there's other factors that come into this. So again, kind of a toy example in the sense that it wasn't a problem that had any real consequence to anything. But it was very much one of those things where like you kind of find these little things that seem unexpected. And then once you kind of think about it more and figure out what actually is kind of happening under the hood, you realize that the dynamics are more expected, and in some cases just more interesting than you may have initially thought.
Awesome. Yeah, no, I mean, as a fellow MBA fan, I'm like really excited to see this getting published. So hopefully we'll get to learn more about your process.
Should be in the next week or so.
Very cool. Awesome. Switching gears a little bit, one thing that I want to talk about was how you think about moving from Excel, spreadsheets, Google Sheets, whatever, to other tools like Python and SQL. Something that I talk about a lot on the podcast and my newsletter, learning Excel is great. You know, there's billions and billions of people using it, but how do you think about analysts moving from this tried and true piece of software to other data tools that can really benefit their career and their business?
So I think it's an important skill to learn some of these other things that Excel is. So I did the same transition. I basically started in Excel. I mean, I like learned a little bit of like R and stuff, like I said, in college, but in my DC job, I was overwhelmingly working in Excel. Excel is really powerful and you can do a lot of stuff with it. I don't think of it as you can't be a good analyst with Excel. That to me, being a good analyst isn't a matter of technical skill. It's not a matter of like how fancy is the model you build or you know how involved is the math that you do. Some of the best analysts I know are people who don't know anything beyond Excel, but they're really, really clever in how they ask questions. And when they're trying to understand something that's difficult to measure directly, they're really good at coming up with ways to measure it with the data that they have. But what learning these other skills really lets you do is it opens up like how quickly you can do these sorts of analyses and how many questions you can ask, basically. Like it's a way to be able to automate the process of asking some questions so that you can just do this much, much faster. And so, you know, if you can answer one question in a day or you can answer 50 questions in a day, it's not that Excel makes you ask worse questions. It's just that you have to go through a lot more manual work to do it. And so you only get so far. And really that like limits the point at which you decide, hey, I don't want to ask anything else. If it's going to take me a day to ask another one, maybe like this is good enough. With these other tools, because you can do them so much faster, what ultimately you're able to do is just take those analyses further. Like if I didn't know Python, this idea of incorporating, figuring out like, oh, it was the good teams that were always just tied, I wouldn't have been able to do because I had to go find other data to do it. And I had to use Python to scrape it. And like, if I had Excel and I had to manually copy and paste stuff, I just wouldn't have done it. So it wasn't, Python was like some sort of special thing where it's like, I needed to learn PyTorch to build a bunch of models. I was still basically just making bar charts, but I needed a tool to be able to automate a bunch of processes to be able to do that. And learning tools like Excel lets you do it. Learning tools like SQL lets you do it on larger data sets. So it just opens up a lot of these other kind of tools that you can't have otherwise. The one caveat I would have to that though, is I do think there's a little bit of a danger in learning advanced stuff, which is you can kind of get addicted to it. So when I was learning stuff to do stuff in D3, this was a while back, after some period of time, it became everything I was doing was like, what's the fancy visualization I want to create for it? Like I have this ability to do this. I want to use it. And in a lot of cases, at least from making fancy visualizations, great. But for like an analytical perspective, you don't need that. Sometimes you just need a chart. And the ability to create something that's like, I don't want to make just a bar chart. Why would I do that? I can make something that's this interactive, crazy thing. Like, it may not be that that's what it calls for. That there's this analogy I always use that, and I think this is true. I said this enough that I hope it is, that I think young female climbers tend to be a lot better than young male climbers. And I think it's because the reason I think that is true, and if it is true, this is why, but because that men tend to have much stronger upper bodies and therefore they can like muscle their way up. So they don't learn technique because in the early stages of learning climbing, you can just kind of do it wrong and just like lean on the fact that you're strong enough to pull yourself up. A lot of younger women don't have that ability. So they learn like much better technique and they learn how to climb without having to rely on just muscling their way up. And so I think like if you learn a bunch of advanced tools, you're essentially muscling your way through problems, which isn't always going to be the way to get the best answer. And so it's you're better off in some cases, like making sure you're asking, is this the right tool for me to be using here? It's good to have that ability to use it if you need it, but you shouldn't be the thing that you always use just because you can.
It's interesting. That's the first time I've heard someone say, don't learn the advanced features, because I think the common misconception is that, well, if I learn these advanced features, that means I'm much more, you know, marketable or something as an analyst or as a potential employee. But I think the skill you're trying to harp on is more about knowing when to use the tool for the right situation or scenario or use case. Is that right?
Yeah. And I think that the tooling thing is an interesting, like there's a whole, that is an interesting conversation in of itself to me, where, and this is a whole other rant, that data science is not a technical job. It is, and like learning the technical skills is important, but I think it's easy for people who want to become data scientists and stuff like that to see, you know, you search for how do I be a data scientist, and you're going to get a bunch of results that are courses on learn this language, learn these packages, learn, like there's a lot around just the technical skill, and it feels very much like I have to learn a bunch of technical skills. Yeah, I'm going to have the six lines on my resume that are the various languages that I'm familiar with, and then that's what I need to do. That stuff is helpful, sure, but like the job is how to ask questions. The job is how to take an ambiguous business problem or ambiguous question about basketball and turn it into something that you can answer with data. And the technical tools are there to make that easier, but they're not the solution. The solution is the thing you're figuring out. And so I think because though, for some reason, we've like made this more sort of technology and tool oriented than I think it perhaps should be, it becomes the emphasis for both what people think of they need to do to develop the skills. It also, I mean, there's also some, I think, like self-enforcing elements of that where it becomes the thing that like recruiters recognize they need to filter on. It becomes a thing that interviewers ask about. So you sort of have to do some of that to get the job. But then when you're actually in the job, nobody's testing you on that stuff. They're testing you on, I just got a really ambiguous business problem that I want someone to have like some strong insight on. And suddenly all of the, you knowing the ins and outs of various machine learning libraries doesn't get you very far.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. The, I guess kind of transitioning a little bit from that into stuff you're working on at Mode. And I saw a post that you wrote on the modern data stack. Mm-hmm. And you talk about the pros and cons, I believe, of business intelligence tools, which is obviously Mode's bread and butter. And you mentioned something about how there's no place, one of the, I guess, deficiencies in BI tools is that there's no place to find the actual metrics. And it's hard to do that consistently for all these BI tools. And I'm curious if you can talk more about your thoughts on self-service BI tools, which is what Mode is, I believe. So I'm curious about the different kind of like opinions you have about that, because it seems like you were making an opinion about self-service BI tools, but at the same time, you're saying like we're on the way there, but just curious about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of things in there. On the self-serve piece, so as an industry, we need to figure out ways to provide data to other people who aren't data professionals. Like a big part of what an analyst's job is, or an analytics team or data science team's job, is to enable the rest of the organization to use data. I think we kind of get wrong what that organization wants to do with it, though. Most people who are using data want to use it for trying to answer kind of basic questions about what's going on in the business. And they typically ask those questions kind of oriented around metrics. So if you ask a salesperson, how are we performing this quarter? They basically will want to pull a series of metrics that are the metrics they understand of like, well, what is our close rate? What is our ACV? What is our, you know, revenue so far booked this quarter? It's not analysis in the sense that an analyst would do it, where it's like, let me dig into the data and figure out how these things are related and you know, derive some insights. It's more of a survey. It's more of a, here are the metrics that I know are interesting. This one's up, this one's down, this one's kind of flat. My conclusion from aggregating all the things together is the quarter is okay. BI tools, I think, should enable that. Like self-serve needs to enable that kind of working of people looking for these sort of surveys of numbers. I think beyond that, this gets back to like data science and analytics being not a technical skill, where if you're trying to say, hey, here's a bunch of data as a non-analyst, sort of technicalness doesn't matter. It's more someone who doesn't have that background. That's a really hard thing to do. You're saying like, great, you have the technical ability to sort of manipulate this data however you want, but now it's up to you to figure out how to draw conclusions from it, how to like ask questions of it. That's a really hard thing to do if you don't do it a lot. It's, you know, if you give me a tool that as a give me a tool that lets me put pixels on a page wherever I want to put them. That's not going to make me a good designer. Like my gap with being a designer is not that I can't arrange the things on the page the way I want them. It's that I don't know how to do it in a way that it actually works. And so I think the same is true for analysis. The gap for most people to like draw insightful conclusions from data isn't, I don't know how to manipulate the data such that it'll tell me that. It's that I have to ask questions as a way to draw that insight out. And that's just not a thing that I've practiced. So really, I think what we as like self-serve should be providing is more of an orientation around metrics, more of an orientation around like, these are the main things you want to look at. How do I look at these numbers and cut them by the dimensions and filter them by the whatever sort of segments and stuff I want to filter them by. But we don't yet have a great way to define that level of data yet. The metric definition typically is still people exporting stuff to Excel and kind of computing their own charts and graphs. And so what that means is like that metric calculation is defined in Excel formulas, or it's defined in those sorts of things. And so there then it becomes a kind of broader, how do we have sort of a shared repository of what these things actually mean and stuff like that, if everybody's computing them differently. So my belief is, yeah, that self-serve is important. What self-serve actually needs to do isn't make everybody an analyst, but give everybody access to kind of the core data sets that they need, and then figure out a way to centralize how we actually do like the standard computations on top of those data sets.
Mm-hmm. And one question I had about, and kind of piggybacking off something you said there, is I feel like a lot of tools, data or otherwise, you know, they have a certain opinion about how a job should be done. And just taking as an example, like we have Google AdWords for, you know, online advertising. The platform is there for you to use. And there's a whole bunch of salespeople at Google who are pushing you to use it a certain way so that you can spend more money on the platform and give Google more money. Do you think BI tools, data tools also have an opinion about how analysts or, you know, people outside of the analytical realm should be looking and analyzing data? Or do you think like there's a general rule of like, it sounds like you're just going to say like, just ask better questions. But I'm always thinking about like, is the data tool I'm using right now, is it trying to like influence the way that I do analysis to a way that's beneficial to this platform that may not be kind of relevant in the future or to other platforms I might use? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of like a loaded question, but something been on my mind recently as I'm using more data tools and other SaaS tools.
I don't think data tools have a lot of opinions about how to, yes and no. So I think tools tend to have opinions about the ways in which that you should conceive of analysis and what analysis means. And I think that dictates the types of analysis that you do indirectly, even though the tool probably would say it's kind of agnostic to that, though I don't think in effect it is. So what I mean by this is take Tableau. Tableau is in effect a giant pivot table. It's like a giant visual pivot table. That encourages you to think of data in a certain way. It encourages you to think of data where the thing you want to do is group stuff together, aggregate it in different ways, look at it by different segments, look at it by different dimensions, and kind of compare those things in that kind of way. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you want to do something else, if you want to start doing analysis of time series or like sequential series of events, it doesn't really lend itself to that. Sure, you can get there. Tableau has a bunch of like sort of backdoors for being able to create these kind of things. But doing something that is around like, I want to analyze the sequential steps that someone took, a pivot table is not really the right approach to that. But Tableau is sort of built on top of a pivot table. So that's how you think of the problem. So say you're now approaching a problem where the question you really want to ask is, I want to understand of the people who take this action, you know, what sort of branches do they go after in my product? Like the people who land on this, who put an item in their cart, where do they go from there? And like, what other steps they take and things like that, where it might lend itself better to this kind of sequential type of analysis. If you're using Tableau, it's hard to do that. So you might think of solving the problem in a different way. You might think of like, all right, well, how do I sort of fit my question into one that Tableau is a little bit more comfortable with? Again, that's not really a criticism of Tableau necessarily. It's not saying it's wrong. It's just that when you have a room shaped a certain way, you're going to kind of put furniture in it that fits the room. You don't have to, but like you kind of start to just align yourself with that way of thinking. you know, and so say you're using SQL. SQL doesn't do statistical analysis well. It's really good at joining data together. It's really good at like grouping stuff. It's really good at like sort of simple aggregates, but it's really bad at statistical analysis. If you're using SQL, you're probably not going to do a bunch of statistical analysis. You're not going to do a bunch of like comparisons of groups and look at things like sort of the standard like t-tests and stuff like that of different groups and trying to figure that stuff out, because it doesn't like get you there. And so I think a lot of these tools will have the approach that they think of as like, this is their interface for interacting with data that isn't designed around a specific type of analysis, but it changes how you think of it and how you conceive of what it is you're working with in ways that I think is a little more subtle. So it is something to sort of be careful about. And I, you know, to sort of pitch Mode in this, one of the reasons Mode is the way it is, where it has SQL and Python and R and the visualization pieces, is all of them are slightly different formulations of ways to analyze data. And we want people to be able to choose the one that is most appropriate for the question they ask. It doesn't always work. And sometimes people are just more comfortable in one versus the other. So that's what they're going to work in. But there is no one that is right or wrong. It's just a matter of, there's some problems for which the Tableau way of thinking is exactly right. There's some for which the SQL way of thinking is exactly right. There's some for which like an R-based way of thinking, which tends to be a little bit more statistical, is exactly right. Like, you got to kind of choose. And so in that case, it's more of like letting the question dictate the tool as opposed to the tool dictate the question.
Sorry, I was on mute. Yeah, I like the way how you use the question to dictate the tool. That's really interesting. Just kind of wrapping up here a little bit, I'm curious about what's coming up on the Mode product roadmap and what's in the future for Mode. Anything you can share with the audience?
Yeah, I mean, so broadly speaking, Mode has always been a product that has focused on enabling analysts and data scientists to be better at their jobs, to be able to work more quickly, to answer questions more quickly in flexible ways. And as I talked about, like, you know, we have SQL and R and Python and visualizations and like sort of a drag and drop visualization thing, all kind of around that is, you're an analyst, you have questions. How quickly can we get you from question to answer? One of the things that so ultimately our kind of mission is to make analysts happy and give them so they can answer questions more quickly and sort of increase how much their organizations know. One of the things, though, that's very much true about that is analysts aren't happy unless their customers are happy. That if you're an analyst and you're trying to serve an executive team, even if you love the tool you're working in, if you send it to your executive team every time, you're like, I can't use this thing, you're not happy. Like, we're not doing our job of serving you if you have to overcome a bunch of objections from other people when they use it. So where we want to go, like, right now is thinking about how do we extend some of that functionality from analysts into the rest of the organization. Mode will always be an organization that is, and a company and a product that is focused on the analyst first. Like, that is our, that they are our champions. They're the people that you know, we really want to make sure we're making happy. But we can't just serve the things they do. Like, once they're, to make analysts happy, you have to serve the people who aren't just them. There are other people who use their products. Like, analysts are tool builders for other people. So we want to, like, a lot of the next focus is thinking about how do we make like the visualization system way better? How do we make kind of the architecture of Mode more supportive of that idea that yes, the analyst is still at the center of kind of the data organization, but they have to hand the thing off to other people that needs to get used by them. Let's make sure we're making a really great experience for those folks as well. And so that the way we really kind of think about this is, analysts should be focused on kind of pushing the frontier of what an organization knows, that we have novel new questions. We have stuff we've never considered. We have big strategic questions that aren't areas that have been sort of charted before. We want analysts to be able to focus on that. When they answer those questions, then let the rest of the business, the domain experts, kind of come in behind them and take that piece of knowledge they learned and extend it and say, all right, we're going to fill in all the details. We're going to kind of expand that base of knowledge into all of the subsequent questions that a sales team will ask when you give them a dashboard on here's how sales performance is. There's going to be 50 questions about like, what about this? What about this? What about this? What about this? How do we enable other people to answer those questions so that the analysts can kind of continue to push the frontier of the organization, which is, you know, that's ultimately what they want to do. And the business teams that are kind of coming in behind them want to be able to answer these questions on their own without having to bother an analyst every time to do it.
Very interesting. Yeah, I like that. I think even at my company, when we use it's, I feel like the way that this gets that the way that some dashboard that someone builds internally in Mode, because shared at my company, is like, here's a dashboard, just plug in the values you want. And we're starting to see these really user-friendly dashboards, basically, where you can basically put things in and then it sparks, like you said, questions from the sales team or product team, which then leads to more dashboards being created and being shared around with the company. So definitely see that.
Yeah.
I guess my final question here is kind of, if you're open to answering this, is there's obviously a whole bunch of other BI tools, data tools out there. What are some tools that you see as potentially competitive with Mode on, and you're seeing features that they have that maybe Mode wants to get into? Just curious about like your kind of a purview of the data tools landscape.
Yeah. I mean, so there's obviously, there's a lot of new stuff out there. There's a lot of, you know, the data is a popular space, you know, in terms of like the competitors that we have. You know, the big tools are like Looker, Tableau, are the kind of common modern BI tools out there, I would say. We see ourselves as competitive with those sometimes. Obviously, if you're trying to build dashboards and reporting, Mode can do that, Looker can do that, Tableau can do that. But a lot of times there's also cases where Mode will exist alongside those because they focus on dashboarding and reporting and kind of the BI world. We can focus on also do like the advanced analytics and kind of the way that analysts work. So in terms of, you know, like what is it that's like interesting and stuff out there? I think there's a lot of new stuff that's come out about like, what else do you do with your data that's beyond dashboarding or kind of like data scientists asking questions? And so for us, I think our main focus is thinking about how do we build something that is cohesive across all of these different uses of data? That it's not, you know, 10 years ago, data was just like reporting. Then we started to add on a bunch of other stuff. Now there's like all these operational uses for it. There's advanced analytics for like drawing insights from data. There's like advanced analytics and data science for building predictive models and those sorts of things. There's the operational side of it. There's a bunch of different like ways that data needs to get sort of spread out throughout the organization. And so for us, it's figuring out kind of what is the right setup for a customer in that world. Like the pieces are still kind of coming together where we're figuring out the sort of correct ways that people should build their data infrastructure up until there. And now we're still trying to figure out like, what does this all look like for how people actually consume it? And so for us, ultimately, like, you know, we see Mode as being kind of overlapping in a lot of cases with any tool that consumes data, because that's what Mode is, one of those interfaces for consuming it. But that doesn't mean it's like always competitive. People have sort of different stacks at this point, different ways of thinking about it. And so we're still, you know, I think that landscape is still a little bit too determined, but if for just like the traditional BI use cases and stuff like that, obviously there's some overlap with us and like Looker and Tableau, but we see BI as being only part of the puzzle. And so, you know, we're kind of focused more on how do we solve the broader puzzle than just the BI puzzle.
Very cool. Well, Ben, I really appreciate your time today, and I wrote a bunch of notes. We'll include this in the episode notes, and yeah, really excited to see what happens to Mode. And I'm sure a lot of the listeners and audience here will also be interested in seeing what happens next as well. Anything else like to leave with the audience before we go?
No, I just appreciate you having me on. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, this has been great. It was very interesting. And thanks for inviting me.